I'm Susan Stamberg. I began my career as a secretary. I won't mention the decade, but let's just say Abraham Lincoln was president. It was a good job, and I have to say, blushingly, I was good at it. I could type 99 words a minute. In spite of that talent, I got bored, and I looked around for a new job, and found it in radio. When I started, I worked mostly behind the scenes. That's what women did. I edited audio tape, wrote copy, booked interviews. I was even the weather girl when the real weather girl got sick. My radio debut. Later, at National Public Radio, I filled in as co-host of All Things Considered, and the phones lit up. A few months later, the men in charge of NPR offered me the job as host full-time. This promotion may sound unremarkable now, but I assure you, in 1972, it was not. I became the first woman to anchor a national nightly news program. And so it's as a fierce advocate of firsts for women that I bring you these stories about the first woman to run for president, the first congresswoman, the first black woman to run for president, and women voting for the first time. Many of these pieces were aired by NPR just as the women's movement was defining itself in the early 70s and 80s, and many of them I reported myself when they were news. I'm just so proud to share them with you now. In 1872, 24 years after the first conference at Seneca Falls, the first woman in American history ran for president. Her name was Victoria Woodhull.
My name is Scott Claflin, and I am a descendant of Victoria Claflin Woodhull. The first time I began to become aware of my relative was in 1964, when the Republican Senator Margaret Chase Smith was running for President of the United States.
Senator Smith, posing now for the photographers, wearing her traditional robes, looking very happy and very pleased about the whole thing.
They were talking about history being made, with Margaret Chase Smith being the first woman to run for president. We're watching, and my dad said, "That's not right. These guys don't know what they're talking about."
My name is Amanda Friskin, and I wrote the book Victoria Woodhull's Sexual Revolution. Woodhull came from an unusual family, the Claflins. She grew up in a small town in Ohio, but they moved a lot, kind of traveling salesman, catch-as-catch-can. And at the age of 14, Woodhull was married off by her parents to a man who proved to be an alcoholic. And she had a pretty hard life with him. She was traveling around when she said she had a revelation to go out there and declare her right to be a woman in public and to be a powerful woman. And so she packed up and came to New York.
This was an era where a woman could not vote, could not enter a restaurant, a store, an establishment of any kind unless she was escorted by a man. It was controversial for women to do anything, but she had the foresight not to accept the way society was.
She started a radical newspaper. She opened the first woman's stock brokerage firm. But the thing that gave her national fame was when she sent a card to the New York Herald declaring her candidacy for the presidency.
Letter to the New York Herald, April 2nd, 1871. I claim the right to speak for the unenfranchised woman of the country.
Author Betty Friedan came to our studios in 1986. She was being honored in Washington for her work in the women's movement and for her book, The Feminist Mystique, which was published in 1963. She told me she was pleased with the progress women had made, but was constantly reminded that those gains could be eroded by some current attitudes.
The women shouldn't stay home again. The women shouldn't, you know, go out and work. If they have a hard time getting jobs, it'll be a nice time to try to sell a younger generation on the idea that all you need to do is get married, have children, and this will take care of the rest of your life. Now, the younger women do want to marry and they do want to have children, but they can't retreat, and they better not be seduced into retreating from that ability to have their own voice and move in the society and earn and have their own self-respect and a degree of control over their own lives. And because that was worth fighting for these last 20 years, and we don't want to be pushed back from it.
What is the statistic? Is it 49 cents on every dollar or 59 cents on every
dollar? Women's pay on the average is about 60 cents for every dollar man's pay. And the main reason for this is that women, most women are still in these service, sales, clerical jobs that pay even less than they're worth because women have always done them. And the other reason for that is that there is still a remnant of sex discrimination, which is serious. And the third reason is that women, up till now, have traditionally taken some years off when they have children. And the women have been, you know, put sometimes hopelessly behind in a career sense or a monetary sense by this. And these are some of what I call the second stage issues the next generation has to deal with. The structure of jobs, the structure of work, maternity and paternity leaves and sabbaticals.
Ms. is the magazine that put sisterhood into the top row of American periodicals. It has made the case for equal pay and equal opportunity, drawn national concern to battered women and sexual harassment, shown homemakers they are also feminists, and shown feminists that caring for a family is also activism. Ms. has asked on its cover, "Do you know the women's movement has no sense of humor?" and answered with a punchline Fanny Bryce would have been proud of. Gloria Steinem, the co-founder and consulting editor of Ms., spoke with NPR's Scott Simon on the magazine's 25th anniversary in 1997.
Let's not make people wait for a punchline. Do you know the women's movement has no sense of humor?
No, but hum a few bars and I'll fake it.
Was that
I don't
the most...
think we originated that line, but we liked it.
Was that one of the most popular covers in your 25-year history?
Yeah, it was. It was. And also, there was a cover that showed a young man with his baby.
Right.
It was beautiful.
I remember that one. In fact, friends would send me copies of that. They doted on that so much. When the magazine started in 1972, there were a great many people in and out of the industry, for that matter, that in a very practical way just didn't give it much of a chance to succeed.
That's definitely true. In fact, Harry Reasoner went on television with a national review of the magazine saying it could not possibly last for more than 6 months. And after 5 years, I think he apologized, which was very nice of him, actually.
And what do you think made the difference in those early years?
Well, really, there was just no other place where you could depend on news that assumed that women were equal human beings. Other magazines were still arguing about it or not covering it at all. And for a series of reasons that have to do not with the editors but with the advertisers, women's magazines still have not changed as much as their readers have.